This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Isabella Pittaway with you for The Country Hour this Thursday. Bit of a shorter program today as we'll be taking you back to the cricket after the weather. But before then, we're going to head to the Northern Territory to what could be Australia's most remote oyster farm. And Kangaroo Island pastoralists are planning to increase their stocking densities to take advantage of the strong sheep market. That story soon on The Country Hour. But first up today, and Australian market access has been granted to Indian table grapes. India exports mostly to European markets, but imported grapes will likely hit our shelves in the coming months, coinciding with domestic harvest between January and March. Australian Table Grape Association CEO Jeff Scott has downplayed the news and says it's unlikely the imports will be a threat to Australian growers.
Australia has to accept that if we wish to export our table grapes, as we do, we are one of the largest fresh fruit exporters from Australia. We also have to accept that other countries will be applying for access to Australia. Now, India, while they are a very, very large producer of table grapes, their primary export destination is to Europe. So I would not envisage India sending a great deal of grapes to Australia. And if they were to do so, I think they'd be choosing specific areas where perhaps there is a high Indian population. As we've found with Korea and China, when they've gained access, they've sent very minimal product, but primarily to the Chinese and the Korean communities themselves.
So you mentioned there you don't really see many Indian grapes being exported to Australia in the future, in the long term. Why do you think that is?
In terms of the consumer taste and everything else like that, the Australian consumers do like Australian grapes during our domestic season. We have other countries that have gained access to Australia, such as Chile, who are one of the largest exporters of grapes throughout the world, and yet they don't ship to Australia. I think you find that India have very substantial markets in other countries, as I mentioned before, to Europe, and I think you'll find that they'll be continued their export program to those countries. A lot of other countries use Australia as a benchmark because Australia does have very strict biosecurity guidelines. And if countries can go through the process to gain access to Australia, well, then that is then seen as leverage to gain access to other countries. So that's the other reason why a lot of countries want to gain access to Australia.
Right. So it's essentially a mark of good quality to be able to send your produce to Australia.
Well, it's a sense that they've complied with strict Australian biosecurity rules and regulations on pest management and disease. So Australia does have very stringent rules along those lines, as we should, being an island nation. So for any country to gain access, they must be able to satisfy very strong biosecurity and phytosanitary aspects of their product to be able to gain access.
Their growing season tends to coincide with ours between January and March. So does that mean that domestic producers are going to be competing against this produce that's coming in the upcoming season?
Look, potentially that's the case. They do overlap with our domestic season. But you know, as I said before, I'd be surprised if India do send, if at all, in great volumes. One thing we need to consider also with our industry is that primarily our main exporters are also our main importers. So in a sense, they would be competing with themselves as well. So the people who export our fruit are also the same people or companies who import fruit into Australia. So, for example, exporter company A also would import American grapes during our off-season. So if they were to import grapes into Australia, say from India or other countries, well, then they would be competing with themselves in terms of trying to gain fruit to export. So I think you'd find that our growers would not take too kindly to that, and maybe react accordingly. So whilst they could be a potential threat, I don't think that there will be many Indian grapes coming into Australia or in large volumes. So they should not pose a significant impost onto our table grape growers for our domestic season.
That's Australian Table Grape Association CEO Jeff Scott speaking to John Daly there. Well, Kangaroo Island pastoralists are planning to increase their stocking densities this year to take advantage of the strength of the sheep market. That's according to Kangaroo Island producer and Ag KI chair Rick Morris, who says producers could increase their herds by up to 20%. However, he says first producers will need to upgrade their pastures to deal with the increase in stock.
Exciting times in the livestock industry, particularly for Kangaroo Island, coming off a pretty good year. Everyone's keen to continue on with that momentum, and there's a lot of work going into one of the AKI projects is looking at fertility mapping, and that involves mapping pH, but also some of the macro elements like phosphorus, potassium and sulphur, and it's showing up some amazing variation across some soil type, and it's really going to give us some good information to go forward and make our lime sand and fertiliser applications a lot more targeted and more efficient.
Why the big interest in upgrading the pastures?
Fertility in particular, I guess it's a finite resource, phosphorus in particular, but our country's so responsive to it. Some areas that where you've got a fairly low phosphorus buffering index, you don't need to put on so much phosphorus, and it's pretty expensive. So we've got areas that might be 40, 50 parts per million phosphorus that don't need anything, and then we've got, in the same paddock, you've got areas that might be only 15. And complicated by the grazing pressure, you'll get stock that do stick on certain parts of the paddock, and they're excreting and they're keeping some areas of the paddock high in P, and potassium is another one. Where they preferentially graze, it seems to be high in potash. So it's then working out or delivering those elements where they're needed and going back in years to come and mapping the place again and just to see where everything's at. So it's just targeting, just being more efficient with your dollars, with your expenses.
What plans are there to increase the stocking density on Kangaroo Island?
Yeah, there's a lot more work and effort going into not only monitoring livestock, but improving pastures. So traditionally, it's just been annual-based pastures, and there's a bit more criteria now, which is playing a good role, mainly for confinement feeding in the autumn to allow pastures to get away, but it's utilising a bit more summer rain. So, yeah, everyone's interested in upgrading pastures, particularly looking at some of the new Phalaris varieties and Coxfoot. And traditionally, we haven't had good results with perennial ryegrass, but now more and more people are occasionally grazing, and it's more of a management thing, so we think we can get them to persist a bit better and get away from the set stocking system. So there's lots of very exciting trial work, and people are obviously trying to push the systems pretty hard to get their best margin.
Is that going to mean more sheep in a smaller space?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, quite a few of our members now have done their lifetime ewe training and are very good at condition scoring and working out, trying to balance what the sheep need and what they're actually getting and targeting their supplementary feeding. And that's all very exciting stuff. So on the whole, it's trying to make the system so much more efficient.
That's Kangaroo Island producer and Ag KI chair Rick Morris speaking there to Lucas Forbes.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where it is 13 past 12. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Thanks for your company today on The Country Hour. Time for a bit of tyre kicking now. And a soil mapping rover about the size of a golf cart could transform the way farmers manage their land. It's yet another way technology is pushing agriculture into a digital revolution. Megan Ruth is speaking here to soil expert Doug Crawford.
So just out here, we have a geophysics survey platform. It's got an EM38 at the back. It's got an EM31 at the big white pole there. It's got a gamma ray spectrometer at the front. And these are used to map soils across a paddock.
This is soil scientist Doug Crawford boasting the specs of his electromagnetic ground mapping buggy like it's some kind of sports car. And it's probably close to it in the soil surveying world.
And it's got a differential GPS at the top for recording it. So all the data is georeferenced, so you can put it on a map and it collects, say, 100,000 to 200,000 data points across a paddock. And it's quite intensive sampling, and so it gives you a good idea of the within-paddock variation.
Okay, so there's a lot of technical language here. What you need to know is this surveying system on wheels can map out a paddock complete with individual characteristics of the landscape. Soil scientist Doug Crawford says the days of judging an entire paddock on a single sample are gone.
Most farmers in the past would have made decisions on paddocks on the basis of assuming it's uniform, but nowadays we can pull the paddock apart, spatially speaking, and make decisions about parts of paddocks. So now you're seeing the adoption of variable rate liming, variable rate application of other soil fertilisers and so on. And so this is sort of the new adoption that farmers are transitioning into, this kind of intensive management of paddocks to improve the efficiency of fertiliser use.
Is there a particular farmer or crop that this best suits, or is it across the board?
Well, at the moment, the horticultural industries and the cropping industries are the ones that are adopting this because they see the value for money in it. So the grazing industries are not quite there yet. But they're doing other things to working on, such as cutting their paddocks up into really small units and rotational grazing. So that sort of takes out the broad-scale variability to a point.
That was soil expert Doug Crawford from Agriculture Victoria speaking there to Megan Ruth about a high-tech soil mapping robot. Well, let's head north now to what could be Australia's most remote oyster farm, located off the coast of Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory. The traditional owners of South Goulburn Island have been working on developing the farm for more than 6 years in conjunction with NT Fisheries. And this year is set to be the most exciting year yet, with the farm finished, and now they can focus on growing the oysters. Lydia Burton recently visited the farm to find out what it means for the remote Indigenous community.
We've got a couple of different batches of oysters here. So these are about 1 year old.
Yeah, my name's Kono Galaminda. I'm a senior elder and a leader in this community.
So tell me, how significant is this oyster farm for your community?
Well, we've been gathering. Our people used to go out and gather oysters out in the wild, the milky ones, back in the 50s and 60s, and that was sold locally, especially in the top end of this country, like in a small scale. But this one is a big one. It's going to hit the... Well, hopefully it's going to... Yes. We're making progress, and it's going to be a record for our community, small community.
And it is a small community, about 350 people?
Small community, but we have hit the gold mine, and this is where I think the world is going to look at us as a place where we've succeeded with our project.
You hope that your oysters are known around the world as the best?
The water is pristine water. And also, yes, it's one of the American journal, aquaculture journalists, quoted, the best oysters comes from Warawi community, small community. It's quoted, and we've got record of it.
Sometimes these programs, you know, there's a lot of energy and investment at the start, and then it fades away. What makes you sure that your community can sustain this long term?
The thing about the whole project is it's based on community support. That's it. And I get community supporting the whole venture, and it's growing. That's how you... If you want to see anything grow, you need to be supported. And I got the support from the community.
You have a really big smile on your face. How are you feeling inside, you know, being able to show people what your community's doing?
Look, I'm so excited that, you know, like we've got it now, and we want to show the other communities along the coast that we can do it, and we have succeeded, and this is a time for us to be proud of, and I'm proud of the success that we have achieved. It's a dream that I've always dreamt about, you know, getting to the end. And this is a dream come true.
It's Paul Armstrong. I work for NT Fisheries with the Aquaculture Group, and I'm based out at the Darwin Aquaculture Centre on Channel Island.
How long do you think before South Goulburn's ready to produce oysters on a commercial scale?
It's still going to be a couple of years away. There's a few things to go, but it'll be really interesting to see how they go developing their farm in the next year or so. It'll be a really great learning time, and there is potential to grow oysters to market size and to start the process of becoming commercial, the business development. That's really important too, and Yagbani is putting resources into both developing the farm but also developing the business. So I've heard Bunul Galaminda talking about a time frame of sort of 3 to 5 years for sort of like full-scale commercial operation, and I think that's realistic. It's going to take time to get the business developed. And yeah.
What about the training side of things? I know you've been heavily involved with getting the guys, you know, in a position that they can look after when you're not here.
Yeah, so whenever we come out, we're always learning, all of us learning about the oysters. But I provide some training. I get opportunities to visit oyster farms in other states and come back with what I've learned and to share it with the guys here. Okay. But, yeah, the guys know what they're doing. The operations on the farm are fairly simple, grading, maintaining the long lines and cleaning. And the guys have, over the years, they understand those procedures and are good at it and enjoy getting out on the farm and doing those things. So, yeah. And we're able to learn things from each other. So when we go out to collect broodstock oysters, we do it together because Morris is great at finding oysters and saves us a lot of time. And when the things that I do back at the Darwin Aquaculture Centre with the hatchery breeding, I'm able to explain about some sides of the biology that they may not have been aware of before. And so we're all getting a fuller understanding of oysters, and it's really interesting. And I also really enjoy... one of the things like we get to do after work sometimes, if the tide's right, is we'll go and collect some wild oysters and bring them back, and we'll cook them up together. And Morris and Jimmy and Vernon will just make a small fire and then cook the oysters on the fire, and actually brings out a really sweet flavour that I hadn't eaten oysters like that cooked on the fire before. So I'd recommend that to anyone who's interested in trying. It's a great way. And get really nice sweet flavour and some smoky flavour in there as well.
I've not tried them like that either. That's Paul Armstrong from NT Fisheries ending that report from Lydia Burton. And let's stick with seafood, because China could soon be eating more Australian yellowtail kingfish, with Clean Seas signing an agreement with a leading Chinese seafood distributor. Clean Seas Managing Director David Head says the agreement with Han Shan Heian Trading will go a long way to getting more of their product into China.
It's been something we've been working on now for more than a year, is to try and identify the right distribution partners in this very large Chinese market. And we're delighted that we've managed to sign the first of our, what we hope will be a series of non-exclusive distribution partnerships. This one with, of course, Hun Shun, a trading company in the northeast of China, who is one of the biggest distributors of another premium seafood, being king crab.
So when you say distribution, it's basically getting your product out into China?
Yes, this is an organisation who imports around 4,000 tonnes a year of king crab from Russia and then distributes through around 300 wholesalers and distributors across China. Our partnership is designed to leverage their relationships with high-end food service, restaurants, retail outlets who have been interested in purchasing our product. So, yes, we'll be shipping it to them in the very in Dalian and in the northeast of China, and they'll be distributing it to their customers from there.
How important is it to have that that right distribution agreement in such a large country as China?
It's absolutely essential. The Chinese market is very alluring to many people. It's a big market, and we all get very excited. But frankly, it's a complex market. Not a lot of people know much about kingfish in China. Not like salmon or tuna, which has got very well established position in the cuisine and in the dietary market over there in China. So we're having to arrive in China with a new premium seafood, explain why we think this is arguably the best raw fish in the world, and try and persuade chefs that they should be adopting it into their cuisine, into their menus. Now, we expect the early successes for us will come from the international five-star hotels, the very top-level chefs and restaurants who are experimenting with fusion and international cuisine. But in time, we expect there will be an opportunity to also have this move through a broader marketplace.
What has been the response so far to Clean Seas Yellowtail Kingfish?
Well, we're selling into China already. We sell through a number of Australian consolidators who export product up into China. So we're already selling fish into the market, so it does have a position. The reality is, when you take this fish and present it to top chefs around the world, whether they're in Europe, North America, or China, they all seem to have the same reaction, which is, wow, this is an extraordinary fish. So these new partnerships we're establishing are very much about the mechanical ways of getting product through the distribution networks to wholesalers and end users. Our job on top of that is to engage with the leading chefs directly one-on-one so that we can explain to them why they ought to consider putting our kingfish on their menus. And so when the distributors turn up at their door, they know a little bit about it and they're prepared to think about it. And we are separately working on a partnership with a Shanghai-based organization who will be our in-market executional arms and legs, will help us with activation campaigns with chefs, will help us with what's a not easy supply chain into China through all the complexities of the customs clearances and health checks, and help us really make that make that part of the world a market we can access.
That's Clean Seas Managing Director David Head speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. And now let's cross to the Weather Bureau on what is a very hot day, and we're joined by forecaster Vince Rollins. Good afternoon, Vince.
Hello, Isabella.
Now, it was 25 when I left for work this morning, and it's a very hot day. How are things shaping up across the state?
Yeah, look, it still is a very hot day across most parts of the state. We have seen the change go through the far southwest of the state, so it's heading towards Nullarbor at the moment, but currently the temperature in Nullarbor is 44 degrees, so, you know, pretty hot out there. But I would suggest in the next hour or so that the change will go through that part, maybe an hour, couple of hours. So it is moving across the southwest, but we are going to see some very hot temperatures continue over the remainder of the state during today. We do see the sort of southern and western parts of the state cool a little bit tomorrow. And certainly over the weekend, we will see cooler temperatures pushing right throughout the state. But generally today looking very hot. We do have some forecast temperatures in the sort of mid to high 40s in some regions, so yeah, pretty uncomfortable conditions, and unfortunately for those people in the sort of far northeast, those conditions will continue at least through tomorrow, and then they will get a little bit of relief, but then we'll start to see a return to the sort of low to mid 40s early next week, and might even see some maybe getting up to mid 40s, but I think the sort of low 40s would be about right. So all that is really just because we've got a high pressure system sitting in the Tasman Sea, it's sort of pushing northerly winds ahead of this change coming through. So we'll probably see the change reach somewhere around Port Lincoln tonight and then continue to move eastwards during tomorrow. As I said, cooler conditions around sort of western and central parts during tomorrow, and then that cool air just gradually pushing into the northeast pastoral district for tomorrow. So some places, particularly around western coast, are certainly going to see a pretty significant change in temperature tomorrow, probably looking at around that sort of 15 to 20 degrees cooler in some parts tomorrow. So yeah, pretty welcome relief. Not expecting too much as far as weather with this change going through. Could see a little bit of thunderstorm activity up in the far northeast today, maybe a little bit of dust over some of the sort of western parts of the pastoral districts as that change goes through, and again over the northeast pastoral district tomorrow with the movement of the change could see some dust. But once that change moves through, we get a ridge strengthening in the south of the, well, to the south of the state. We go into a southeasterly airstream, and we maintain that for the rest of the forecast period. So we're looking at fine conditions, dry, and much cooler as we head into next week.
Good to hear that there is a cool change coming through. Thanks for keeping us informed there, Vince.
No worries.
That's Vince Rollins at the Weather Bureau. And yes, it is going to be hot for the next couple of days, but we do have a cool change coming through. And yes, as we've just heard, hot today. And that means that the Country Fire Service has declared total fire bans today for the following fire ban districts: West Coast, Lower Eyre Peninsula and Mount Lofty Ranges. The total fire ban will apply until midnight. And the CFS recommends that you implement your bushfire survival plan. Let's take a look now now over to western New South Wales and in the upper western district. A very hot day, partly cloudy with a slight chance of a shower, most likely during this afternoon and early evening. The chance of a gusty thunderstorm with possible areas of raised dust. Daytime maximum temperatures in the low 40s. To the lower western district, very hot and mostly sunny. Slight chance of a shower in the far east, most likely during this afternoon and evening, and the chance of a gusty thunderstorm in the far east with possible areas of raised dust. Daytime maximum temperatures, again, will be in the low 40s. And that's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. We will take you very shortly back to the first day of play at the SCG between Australia and India. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday.
You're listening to ABC Radio.
Hello, and Prue Bentley with you for another half hour or so here on ABC Radio. Our number's here, 1300 222 774. Maybe you've got a non-alcoholic beverage you'd like to nominate as your go-to beverage. You can text us too on 0437 774 774. Now, in a minute, we are going to meet a wonderful Canadian band, French-Canadian band, who are here on tour in Australia. But first, let's hear from them. This is a song that was recorded earlier today in the ABC studios. Le Pont de Lens. Here's my high school French coming into play here. Le Pont de Lens by Les Poules à Colin.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Demande à sa mère pour y aller. J'ai fait un rêve et tu t'étais noyé. l'éclage des lances, elle se met à sonner.
Was Le Pont de Lance by Les Poulets Collins. Quebecois folk band, that's their name, Les Poulets Collins. They're in Australia touring across the country. They're a five-piece and they've been hoovering up fans over the world with their sonorous vocals and moody adaptations of folk classics. I have four of the band with me in the studio now and I will introduce you all with my schoolgirl French. We've got Beatrix Mette. Yeah. Colin Savoie-Levac, Eleanor Pitre,
hello,
and Sarah Marchand. And that's about as much French as I'm going to do today. Yes. Welcome to the studio. Thank you so much. Now, you guys have just been up in Woodford. Can I get you to get a little bit closer to the mic? There we go. You've been in Woodford for the Woodford Folk Festival, which is a marvellous, marvellous festival if you've never been. What was your experience like up there?
It was pretty crazy, and we were just coming from our Christmassy home back from Canada, and we kind of knew what was happening, but not really. We've heard a lot of great things about the festival. It's kind of what everyone talks about in Canada when they're like, Australia, first thing that comes to mind is Woodford.
Is that right?
And they're like, you have to go there. So when we learned that we were going to be playing there, we got so excited, and it was kind of surreal.
Why do they say Woodford Folk? I mean, this is quite news to me. I mean, mostly when people say, the first thing people think of when they talk about Australia is kangaroos and koalas and Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Of course. But I meant musicians. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of, there's a fair amount of Canadian folk musicians who play Woodford. And I think there's a big, big connection there somehow. And yeah, so
kangaroos, spiders, then Woodford.
Exactly.
Third thing, my bad.
I like it. So paint a picture for me. What was Woodford like for you? What did you do there?
Well, we landed in the morning of the 27th and we played a show right away when we got there. So that was starting pretty strong and really awesome. And the cool thing there is everybody dances at every gig. It's really easy to get people up and I don't know, people are excited. There's street animation all over the place, crazy, massive puppets, I guess, walking all over the place, and weird tree people, and lots of very open-minded hippies as well. And
it feels beautiful. Kind of like a little bubble, you know, and you kind of go in.
Well, they do call it Woodfordia, don't they?
Exactly.
They make a whole town.
It is. It really is like this community, and we really felt like we were Woodfordians, and we were camping also, which is this is going to sound very cheesy, but kind of not very common for us to do. I mean, we have camped before, but, you know, usually the artists go off-site and they go to people's houses or hotels. And I think it made it twice as special to be there really 24 hours a day, waking up in the boiling sun, and you had to get up pretty early because it was just impossible to sleep. So it'd be early mornings, late nights, and it was kind of a very, very, very huge experience. And it feels like we've been away for like a month already, but it was only a week, you know?
So. Did you do the cold showers?
Yes, although in the artist's camping, we're lucky enough to sometimes have hot water, so we could get both. Sometimes the cold showers, and sometimes we get a bit of hot water. But at the same time, I'd personally shower after shows and stuff, and it was good to have the cold water after because it's so hot. People were actually talking about how chilly it was compared to the usual, which for us sounded insane because we were just about as hot as we've ever been at a festival. But I guess we're just used to the winter back at home in the minus 15 zone, where this was 30 degrees and very, very sunny.
That's the voice of Colin Savoie-Levac, who is one of the players in Les Poules Collins. And the name of your band, it's kind of funny when it's translated. Can you tell us, Beatrix, can you tell us what the name is?
Yeah, of course. It's good to hear that people find it funny because actually it was a pun that we did 10 years ago. Which unfortunately we're kind of stuck with right now. But the actual history of our band name is that there's a song in the traditional music of Quebec, which is kind of the cliche go-to sing-along traditional song, which a lot of people know, even if they don't listen to traditional music whatsoever. And it's the song is called La Poule à Colin, so Colin's Hen. And it's the story of a chicken that's kind of the wrong place at the wrong time and gets killed and turned into a delicious soup, which the whole town wants to get their hands in, and they just can't stop eating it. And the priest also goes and he misses mass, and so there's all these old ladies who are sad because they don't get to have their church.
That's a very involved story for a song.
Definitely. We used to do the song, actually, but that was a long time ago, and it was a funny joke a while back because our buddy here, Colin, that's his name. So, 10 years ago, that was our humor. Our humor has changed a lot, just so people can understand. We are a lot funnier than that.
Well, you talk about the traditional music. Is it specifically Quebecois music? Is it specifically from that region that you sort of draw a lot of your influences from, or are you sort of, do you spread that?
Well, I guess it's really inspired by the Quebecois tradition. All the songs are from Quebec, but we also take, I guess, all those traditional French songs in North America originate in France, you know, way, way back. So some of them we got from Brittany. We also got a bunch of songs from an amazing collection of archives down in Louisiana. But there are some really beautiful melodies down there, and the archive singers are really good, which is rare. Sometimes it's kind of it changes pitch five times throughout the song, and it's hard to make up the words. But these were really beautiful archives, and some of them also come from our friends from references. So I guess the style of song and the way we sort of find them is very traditional to Quebec. But then we take it from there and we arrange on top of it and sort of make it our own.
It's you're quite young, and I hope you don't mind me saying that. It seems to me that it's an unusual thing for young people to be interested in, which is sort of traditional folk music. Mm-hmm. Beatrix, does that surprise a lot of people?
I think it does. It's for us, it's kind of a funny reaction, or a reaction that we don't quite relate to because we're so used to being surrounded by people that know what we're doing and people that kind of understand where it's coming from in Quebec, I mean. And it's good to point out that all of our parents are active musicians and they all play music in the traditional scene of Quebec. And so we grew up listening to this kind of stuff, and we grew up watching our parents also do it and learning songs, finding songs, going and visiting families and listening to everyone sing. And there's a lot of recordings that have been done, you know, of older people singing their repertoire of their families and their ancestors and all of that. So to us, it's quite normal. And I guess when we meet other young bands, let's say at Woodford, that are maybe the same age as us and they're amazing musicians, but they have a completely different baggage of like information and references, and so it's interesting when we kind of get to be with other artists like that who are the same age as us and who probably listen to the same music that we do. I mean, we don't just listen to archives, obviously, in our phone, just like hundreds of them. No, we listen to a bunch of different kinds of music, and we kind of, I guess, apply whatever we like about them and into the music that we look into in Quebec.
That's the voice of Beatrix Mette, who's one of the five players in Le Poule Colin. And we're also speaking with Colin Savoie-Labac, Eleanor Petra, and Sarah Marchand. They're here touring. They've been to Woodford Folk Festival, heading down south to Victoria and Tasmania. We were joking a little bit while we were listening to your song just before that you've skipped New South Wales this time around.
Yeah, very sorry about that.
Yeah, are you expecting to come back at some point? Because your first time here was in 2017, wasn't it?
It was, and we were here for 9 weeks that last time. So we were like slowly turning into Australians. I swear that we had maybe one word that we can pronounce with the accent after
which
2 months. I know.
I
don't know.
That's close. It's a hard accent, isn't it?
It's very hard, yeah. It's very hard.
That's very good. Very good. I like it. So after 9 weeks, you feel like you become a local. Did you drink the local drinks? Did you eat the local food?
I had spaghetti meatball or spaghetti kangaroo bolognese.
Ooh, I don't think I've even had spaghetti kangaroo.
I have to say, I thought it was going to be like bolognese, and it was like kangaroo spaghetti, and I thought that was just like a joke. But then as soon as I tasted the meat, I was like, this is different. And then I asked, and they're like, yeah, it's kangaroo meat.
Very
which
nice.
Which was quite different.
Talking of cultures, I mean, I kind of want to go back a little step because you were talking a bit about the archives and the sort of the cultural songs. It sounds like there's a really strong cultural tradition for you in your part of Canada. You know, can you just sort of elaborate on that a little bit? What is that culture like?
I'd say the traditional music culture is very strong and sort of goes way back with fiddlers and stuff, and it's influenced by France and Ireland and all of that. But even beyond that, in Quebec, we have this very interesting context where we're the only province in Canada to be majorly francophone. Mm-hmm. Our official language is French, and so we were colonized by France as opposed to England, and so we have this identity which is kind of unique. There's also a bunch of Acadian French and French speakers all through Canada who have very strong identities as well. But in Quebec, we kind of were forced to come up with our own pop culture as well. So we have our own radio shows and TV shows and theater and cinema and music. And so there's only about 8 million of us, but we do have a very rich culture on our own outside of the North American, you know, Anglophone culture. And so it's a proud thing to be coming from Quebec, kind of, and so it's really neat to have this little bubble of culture that's not initially that known from the rest of the world, but is.
Is it hard to, with the onslaught of particularly American culture, is it hard to sort of break out of that and to do the sorts of things that you're doing and be successful, Beatrix?
Well, I think even like earlier than that, for us, it's one step is just to, because we play traditional music, or inspired by the tradition, but one thing is that it's even hard to just step out of that kind of circle, because like Colin was saying, we have our own pop culture, and there's a lot of musicians, and there's a lot of very, very successful and very great musicians in Quebec that are more into like songwriting and stuff like that, which is not really what we do. So there's already that kind of specific part of our music that is not, maybe I wouldn't say not valued as much, but it has always been kind of a struggle for people that play traditional francophone music to kind of come up and step up the same game as like pop music, right? So that's one thing that we've been working on and kind of have had to struggle with, and I think we are kind of coming out of there because people are a lot more open-minded and are intrigued by folk music, and maybe it's because we're young and they maybe have an interest in that. But it's kind of funny because we actually play a lot more outside of our province for that reason, I think, is that people outside of Quebec kind of tend to think where music is maybe more like world music. And so we get we get to play in these festivals like Woodford, or like we've been to Africa and like the Francophone games and things like that, where over there it's like, oh, we're very different, and people, even Anglophones, tend to come out to our shows and really enjoy our show, even if it's majorly in French, you know. So,
and how do French people, I mean, have you toured to France before?
In France?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do they respond to
it? It's
your
funny.
Music?
I don't think first of all, they have a hard time with our accent. That's one thing.
Right.
So
you like the Scots version.
There you go.
Of the French world. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We have toured there. There's a lot, I mean, France has a lot of different parts of it as well. I guess to think that maybe it'd be successful over there, but really, I think our identity is so different, and I don't know. It's hard to tell.
I think they're very also musically very word oriented, where the band will be. It's a very big generalization, but the band tends to be far in the back and the vocal very up front, and we have we like to have a mix where the vocal is kind of blending in to the music too. So I guess that's not a problem, but sometimes a bit of a struggle. But we've had some great times in France too, though.
We better hear a bit more music. And I'd love to thank you for coming in. I know you've got a fairly tight schedule, and you've got a big touring schedule coming up as well. But thank you so much for coming in, Beatrix Mette, Colin. I'm going to try this again. Colin Savoy-Levac, Eleanor Pitre, and Sarah Marchand. The next song we're going to play is called Saint Waves. Just briefly, Colin or Beatrix, do you want to tell me what this one's about?
Sure. So this song is the title track of our second album, and I guess this was the first time that we kind of incorporated one of our original songs. It's a song that I wrote into our music. We kind of wanted to explore this other side to us, which wasn't deeply rooted in the traditional music of Quebec, but it's more of a little folky, poppy side of us. So it's a song that I wrote when I was very young, and I literally do not remember why I wrote that, but one of my first songs, I guess.
Well, let's hear it. Saint Waves.
Thank you.
That's Le Poulet Colin, and that was recorded earlier today in the ABC studios. So it's just like being there. Saint Waves is the name of that song, Le Poulet Colin, and they are playing tonight if you're in Melbourne at the Spot at Mallard. They'll be touring Victoria, and then they'll be heading to Tasmania to play the Signet Folk Festival. But if you are interested in seeing them, just pop Le Poulet Colin into your browser. You're listening to ABC Radio. Coming up to news, Annie Gaffney's on Afternoons. Annie, hello.
Hello, Prue. I bet you're feeling a little bit hungry right now at the end of your program.
Well, how did you guess? Yes, we've been sitting here for 3 hours and I haven't had nary an apple.
Working up an appetite. Mm. Did you know that the latest trend is for home cooks to dish up some goods on Marketplace, which is a Facebook platform where you can buy and sell goods. Lots of food up there for sale if you ever keen to check it out. Everything from Lebanese meatballs to fantastic Filipino spring rolls.
Why, but yes, I am, Annie Gaffney. That sounds delightful.
How legal is that, though, yeah, for home cooks to be dishing up this food? We don't know how many of them have got commercial kitchens and licenses in place, and yet the public seems hungry for these different international food offerings. So we're talking Facebook food on the other side of the news. We're also talking the value of trees, especially when it comes to our mental health and our overall health when we live in big cities like Melbourne and Sydney. Can you put a dollar figure on a tree? Apparently you can. And a little later in the program, the fascinating topic of psychics and how mediums are being used sometimes to help police try and crack or solve criminal cases. So it should be a bit of an interesting program this afternoon.
I think it will be. Annie, good luck and have a great rest of the festive season.
Thank you. You too, Prue.
Annie Gaffney is on After the Radio on Afternoons on ABC Radio. And that's pretty much it for us here in our little studio. I do want to say a special thank you to my team who've basically kept this ship afloat for the last couple of weeks. John Standish, James Findlay and Jules Hayes on the buttons and dials. Thank you very much, and particularly James for making some lovely muffins today to keep us all going. It's been a great pleasure being with you over the last few weeks here on Summer on ABC Radio. Stick around. There's plenty more radio to sink your teeth and ears into, but that's it for me. It's news time.
Hey, Tom Tilly here. Check out my show and a bunch of others on the new ABC Listen app. Stream your favourite ABC radio stations live, find your new favourite podcast, and hear the world differently with the new ABC Listen app. Download for free today.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.